Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth of Florida's economy depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust works with the business community to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital team members. More information is at abletrust.org. From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
Technically, Florida may not have any sanctuary cities, but a new state law makes sure no city decides to become one.
Sanctuary cities basically create law-free zones.
Also this week, assault weapon opponents say a constitutional amendment might be the only way to outlaw those guns in Florida.
Our children were literally hunted as if they were enemies on the battlefield.
We'll also delve into the latest salvo fired in the battle between supporters of traditional public and public charter schools in Florida. And we'll sit down with the president of Florida State University to ask why his school is the latest to place the administration of its athletic program under a private entity. I'm Tom Flanagan. This is Capitol Report. Today, Governor Ron DeSantis approved a ban on so-called sanctuary cities in Florida. Ryan Daly reports the effort sparked controversy during this legislative session, but its backers say it's all about following the rule of law.
This is about the rule of law. It's also about public safety.
That's Governor Ron DeSantis, who signed the bill flanked by Republican allies from the state and national level. He says the new law prohibits Florida municipalities from refusing to work with federal immigration authorities.
You know, this bill's very simple. If you have somebody in our possession, if the sheriff has somebody in our possession who's here illegally, committing criminal offenses, it is our state's policy that we work with the federal government so that those individuals can be removed from our communities.
Proponents of the measure have maintained the law would only apply to those in the country illegally who have committed crimes. Republican Senator Joe Gruters was the bill's principal backer in the Senate.
Listen, if you're an illegal alien and you're here and you're obeying the laws, you're being a good member of the community, working hard, kids in school, you have nothing to worry about regarding this bill. This bill only comes into play is if you're in the judicial process, if you get arrested, if you get processed.
But the bill didn't get passed without a fight. During the signing, Gruters recounted the dizzying number of amendments filed, many in the waning days of session.
There was 244 amendments filed on this bill over the course of the cycle. We had to pass it twice off the Senate floor, I think three times off the House floor, which is almost impossible when you think about it.
That opposition and late plays to make changes to the bill came from Democratic lawmakers like Representative Carlos Guillermo Smith of Orlando. As the bill was moving through committees, he called the Federal Immigration Agency's requests for local officials' cooperation a violation of constitutional rights.
ICE detainer requests are just that. It's a request for cooperation with ICE. These are unconstitutional documents, not because I've called them so, but because court ruling after court ruling has said over and over and over again, ICE detainer requests are unconstitutional documents.
Democratic Senator Annette Tadeo criticized the measure as being purely political. In March, she said the bill would deter undocumented immigrants from reporting crimes and abuse.
The fact is, we don't have not even one sanctuary city in Florida. And what we are creating with this bill, unfortunately, on political terms, a lot of parties like to get credit and get some points.
Natalie Chalco is a native of Peru who spoke at a press conference hosted by Senate Democrats on the bill in March. She disagreed with Gruters concerning who the bill would affect.
My dad works at an airport, and sometimes he works during late hours of the night, and has already been stopped twice by the police and found driving without a license. One more stop and it could become a felony, which could lead to deportation.
DeSantis and those at the bill signing invited Keon and Bobby Michael to speak. Their son was killed in a car accident involving a previously deported immigrant who was here unlawfully in 2007.
And Brandon was killed right on the scene. The illegal got out of his car and he sat on a curb and watched our son take his last breath. He did nothing to help him. He did nothing to get him help. and we had to go and force the state to go back to court to prove that he was behind the wheel, and no one was in the car with him.
The family says the man who killed Brandon was given a 2-year sentence and then deported once again. When DeSantis promised action on state immigration policy during his State of the State address, the Michael family were his guests.
Had our laws simply been enforced, Bobby and Keon might not have had to bury their son. So let's do the right thing by the Michael family. Let's prohibit sanctuary cities in the state of Florida.
Hundreds reportedly showed up to watch the bill signing in Okaloosa County. I'm Ryan Daly.
As a response to the Parkland shooting, which left 17 dead, Ban Assault Weapons Now is pushing to get assault weapons banned in the state through a constitutional amendment. Earlier this week, the group announced the effort has reached the threshold to trigger a Supreme Court review. Capitol reporter Blaise Gainey speaks with the campaign chair about what exactly the ban does.
I'm with Gail Schwartz, the chairwoman for Ban Assault Weapons Now. The organization has reached 103,000 signatures for the petition to ban assault weapons. Why are you so passionate about this?
My nephew was slaughtered in his school in Parkland, Florida, by an AR-15. He was 14 years old, sitting at his desk in language arts class. And when I heard the stories of what happened to him and survivors of the shooting and the horrific massacre that occurred there and how our children were literally hunted as if they were enemies on the battlefield. I said to myself, this can't be the society that we as citizens of Florida choose for our loved ones. We have to do something to change the laws. This can't be acceptable. We shouldn't have to live in fear that when we go to any public outing, we might be exposed to a shooting rampage. And as I started researching it, I came across an article in my local newspaper that explained how the Parkland students could actually get an assault weapons ban. I knew that our legislature wasn't willing to even discuss this, let alone bring it to the floor of the Florida legislature for a debate. And since they're not willing to do what is necessary to provide for the safety of their constituents, we as citizens are forced to do it ourselves.
So how did you go about starting this amendment? Because I'm sure several people have thought, hey, we shouldn't have these weapons available to citizens. But since 2004, when the federal assault weapons ban ended, nobody's done it.
I followed the instructions from the article. We can do this just through a citizens initiative, ballot initiative process, where we take the issue directly to the voters. And we are allowed to petition for a constitutional amendment if we can gather the required number of signatures, which is 766,000 all throughout the state of Florida. And we can get them all collected by the deadline, which is February 1st of 2020. We could take this issue directly to the voters, and for the first time, we could give voters a voice on the types of weapons that we want sold in our state.
It's no secret that Florida is known as a gun-friendly state, sometimes even jokingly called the Gunshine State instead of the Sunshine. In a climate like we have here in Florida, this petition is likely to get some opposition. What do you say to those who don't want the ban?
We're not looking to take away anyone's hunting rifles or anyone's handguns. This will not prevent anyone from their Second Amendment rights or their right to bear arms. This is simply the military-grade assault weapons that are used to kill as many people as quickly as possible. No one should have the right to own a gun that has the capability of firing 30 rounds in 10 seconds.
With about 8 months until the deadline, the petition has already received more than 100,000 signatures. Swartz says if the petition clears the Florida Supreme Court, voters will ultimately approve it. For now, she is focusing her energy toward meeting the signature requirement. I'm Blaze Gaines.
As planned, the Florida legislature today sent a proposed $91.1 billion budget for the 2019-2020 fiscal year to Governor Ron DeSantis. The governor, who has vowed to use his line item veto power to trim the budget, is expected to sign the document and issue vetoes next week. Stay tuned. The Florida Department of Health is seeking input about how a nutrition program for women, infants, and children can be improved and is giving people 3 weeks to send comments to Tallahassee. The Special Supplemental Nutrition Program for Women, Infants, and Children, commonly referred to as WIC, serves low and moderate income, pregnant, breastfeeding, and postpartum women, infants, and children up to the age of 5. The Florida Lottery wants another look at the potential impact on education funding from legislation that would require slapping gambling addiction warning labels on the front of tickets and ads. Governor DeSantis is getting closer to deciding whether to approve the bill, which passed the House and Senate in early May. An initial projection about the bill's impact on education funding was made in March. But appearing on Wednesday of this week before state economists, the Florida Lottery's director of products said officials have subsequently learned that the warning labels could affect the state's participation in multi-state games such as Powerball and Mega Millions and end scratch-off games that feature the TV shows The Price is Right and Wheel of Fortune, along with board games Monopoly and Scrabble. Still to come on Capitol Report, Florida's ongoing battle over traditional and charter public schools continues and even ramps up.
Enough is enough. You've been given years to turn these schools around. You've been given the first chance to do that, and you haven't.
Florida State University becomes the latest institution of higher learning in the Sunshine State to put its athletic programs under a separate privatized organization.
My intention has never been to not disclose anything about the university that the public has a right to know under law.
And the only Democrat on the Florida cabinet insists she's not shy about working with the Republican majority.
So you'll see a lot of things from our administrations and a lot of things from the cabinet where we are putting state before party.
Ten Florida school districts are suing the state over a massive education law approved 2 years ago. The measure, known by its legislative moniker, House Bill 7069, made big changes to how charter schools are funded and created and how school districts spend federal money on low-income students. Lynn Hatter reports an appeals court recently took up the case.
Most of the fight over House Bill 7069 centers on a provision called Schools of Hope. The plan was championed by former House Speaker and current State Education Commissioner Richard Corcoran. It allows charter schools that open near failing traditional public schools to bypass the local school board and apply directly to the state. It was recently front and center in a dispute between Corcoran and Duval County School Superintendent Diane Green over how to handle some of Duval's lowest performing schools. Corcoran questioned Green's resistance to allowing School of Hope operator Idea Academy to take over some of that district's troubled schools.
I'm not asking you to go gamble with some school that's already been in your district and not succeeded. I'm asking you to go with someone who's absolutely succeeded with 60,000 kids identical to these.
Well, as I stated, I am making a bold move with Northwestern and Lake Forest.
That's no, you're closing them. Why are we just closing them? That's not even good for the community. Those parents don't want those schools closed.
School. You're right. They don't want it closed.
Duval was initially among the 13 counties that sued over House Bill 7069, but it withdrew after a Leon County judge upheld the measure last year. That's led to the current appeal.
Well, it's awfully hard to tell from the questions from the court. The panel was obviously interested and engaged, and they saw the importance of the issue. They raised the questions that I thought they were going to raise, and I think we gave them the answers, the best answers that we had, and now we'll see what the court does with it.
Steve Brannick is representing the remaining 10 school boards in the lawsuit, and he spoke to reporters after the appeals court hearing. The law also requires districts to share locally generated funding with charter schools. And instead of districts having a say over how to spend federal money for low-income students, those Title I dollars are being split among all schools, including charters, depending on the number of low-income students they serve. Charters can also apply for their own federal grants, which could put them at odds with other schools in a district. All are points of contention in the lawsuit. Brannick says those moves diminish the constitutional authority of local school boards and give too much power to the state.
We have these bills that are coming along, and we have this incremental creep where the state takes over more and more control, and it doesn't seem like so much when it's a little bit here and a little bit there. If the court were to rule in our favor, it says, nope, there is a line that you cannot cross. And if that line is there, that line is established, then that at least stops this incremental creep and may perhaps gives an opportunity for the pendulum to shift back the other direction in favor of local control, which is truly what our Constitution requires.
But Florida Department of Education attorney Rocco Testani says the state should be playing a larger role in overseeing all schools.
Enough is enough. You've been given years to turn these schools around. You've been given the first chance to do that, and you haven't.
The appeals court did not immediately rule. That could come in the next 2 to 5 months. Regardless of the outcome, both sides suggest the matter could be decided by the Florida Supreme Court. I'm Lynn Hatter.
The Florida State University Athletics Department is joining with the Seminole Boosters to become a Direct Support Organization, or DSO. The new Florida State Athletic Association will serve as a private, nonprofit umbrella organization, but some are raising questions about accountability and transparency. DSOs are excluded from many of the state's public record laws, despite operating within the state university system. Sean Mulcahy spoke with FSU President John Thrasher.
Well, President Thrasher, to start, give us an overview of what the athletics department is transitioning into. What did it look like before versus how is it going to look now?
Well, what we're doing basically is trying to combine the best of our athletic department and the best of our boosters. And one really has a operational function, a department of athletics, all the coaches and all those types of things. The boosters, on the other hand, have more of a fundraising component to what they do. My view was a number of years ago that we probably need to see if we could bring them together a little closer in terms of certain basic, big, broad things like facilities, you know, making sure we're on the same page about where we want to go with facilities at Florida State University, where we want to go with other aspects, policy aspects, how to raise money.
Well, and to push you a little bit further on that, you know, why now?
Well, that's a good question. And we know that Andy Miller, who's been at the Boosters for 38 years, or I'm losing track of it, a long time, has done some fabulous things over there, and their leadership he's had over the years have done some fabulous things. We had a change in our athletic department in terms of the athletic director, with David Coburn being there now. There's a possibility that all three of us, say, would next 3 to 5 years might be gone, myself including them. So why not try to find the best time? This is the best time, I think, to put the structure together so that whoever comes and replaces any of us will come into a structure where people are communicating, where they're talking to each other, where policy decisions are being made jointly with the boosters and the athletic department. But we need a more collaboration, I think, a better communication about the goals, about the future, and about how we get the best support we can get from both of them.
And President Thrasher, I wonder, could you talk a little bit about the organizational structure? How is that going to look?
Well, we had the athletic department with the athletic director reporting directly to the president, and obviously the entire athletic department. The boosters have a separate DSO in which they have a board that I had some input into as president. They select, though, the president of the booster organization. This organization will be a little more together, whereas the athletic director will be on many of the committees the boosters have, and the booster president will be the second in command of the athletic department. So we will be forced, if you will, regardless of who's there, to have communications with each other, to talk to each other. The overall structure will have a Florida State University Athletic Association. I will be the chairman of that. One of my board members, likely my chairman, will be on it. The chairman of the booster organization will be on it. The faculty athletic representative will be on it. And then I get to choose another faculty member who doesn't report directly to me. So I think it'll be a very, very competent board. It'll be open. The meetings will be noticed. There'll be transparency. You'll see an agenda, and we'll be in public in everything we do.
You mentioned that need for greater communication, and that's something I've heard as well. But can you give some specifics?
Well, I don't say that we're not communicating, but sometimes a booster organization has its own board of directors. The athletic department, it has an advisory committee along with the president. Sometimes we were talking internally, but not talking necessarily together about how we think the boosters could best support the policies of the athletic department. And we worked together for really about the last year looking at different options on how to put this together.
Well, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask. You know, we're not immune to controversy. FSU has had Jameis Winston and DeAndre Francois. And one of the concerns people have raised is about this lack of transparency, essentially taking a part of the school and making it quasi-private.
And, you know, I've heard that, obviously. But I can assure you, and I mean this from the bottom of my heart, none of that was ever the intention of doing this. My intention, again, has been to put us together so we communicate better, we look at our synergies, we look at our priorities, and then we find the best plan to support that financially on behalf of our student athletes. I understand the Sunshine Laws. I lived it when I was in the Florida legislature. I voted on many of those things in the past. My intention has never been to not disclose anything about the university that the public has a right to know under law, and we will continue to do that with this new organization.
But I mean, to be fair, there's no redress for the public if you were to just choose not to provide the records and...
Well, the public opinion redress. But again, I remind you, the organization we put together is being used by the University of Florida and Central Florida and South Florida for years, and other universities the same way. So I don't know what they do. I know that my board and my personal philosophy is that I want to be as transparent as we can, as the law allows us to. If a coach's contract becomes available, we have a new coach, people are going to know about it. I've done that since I've been here. Nothing's going to change in that regard.
That was Capitol reporter Sean Mulcahy speaking with FSU President Sean Thrasher. You're listening to Capitol Report from WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, as the only Democrat on the Florida cabinet and the first woman to ever hold her title, Commissioner of Agriculture and Consumer Services Nikki Fried is the first to admit she's a bit of an outlier.
I wasn't chosen by our fellow Floridians because I looked like, acted like, walked in the same boots as my predecessors.
I believe it was because I have a different vision for this department and the opportunities that we have to look forward in the state.
For one thing, her electoral win this past November over Republican Matt Caldwell was razor thin.
We were victorious by 6,753 votes, and I am every single day so, so grateful and humbled by this experience and knowing that it could have gone the other way.
Still, Frieden says she's not afraid to buck her GOP colleagues on issues like local preemption. That's when the state legislature takes over decisions that used to be done on the city and county level.
Know that you have somebody up here who's going to continue to fight for the local control, because you are the ones in our local governments who know your constituents the best. The ones who voted for you have as much say and as much power in what goes on in your local communities than your members of Congress and your state and House representatives.
On the other hand, Fried says she's looking for common ground, such as working with Governor DeSantis on his much-publicized desire to improve the state's water quality and other initiatives to protect the environment.
The two of us are steadfast in our support for the environment and moving forward. So you'll see a lot of things from our administrations and a lot of things from the cabinet where we are putting state before party.
During her election campaign, Fried says she was often assailed as just another anti-gun Democrat, a perception she's been dismantling in office.
And I kept trying to remind people that, one, I have a concealed weapons permit and I own a gun. My job is to do my job and to follow the law. And so not only we come in here, we change our leadership strategy, we changed and put a different person in charge of our division, a second number two changed, and we changed the culture of our entire licensing division.
Today, Fried says the average time it takes for Floridians to get a concealed carry permit has been cut from 93 to 45 days. She says she's also been working diligently at both the state and national level to expedite, streamline, and cut the cost of patient access to medical marijuana. And then there's hemp, the variety of cannabis that she sees as a potentially massive shot in the arm for Florida's agricultural economy.
So the bill actually was sent to the governor this morning. So if anybody has an ear of the governor, encourage him to sign the hemp bill. My team is working diligently to start the rulemaking process. We have two workshops next week and one the following week. And our goal is to make sure that this is an alternative crop for our farmers.
Even now that both the state and federal government have approved recovery funds for hurricane-devastated northwest Florida, Fried worries that won't help the many families and businesses in that area that depended on the region's now-destroyed forests for their livelihoods.
Timber is a 10- or 20-year process, and so even if they're replanting, there's no return on investment for 10 or 20 years. So without getting this grant dollars to them, they're either going to have to clear the land and sell it to developers, which is not what I would recommend, because that completely changes the environment in that community, and then we lose those lands from agricultural production forever.
Another reason she insists that hemp crops could help the area, at least in the immediate term. Nikki Fried made her remarks earlier today before the Capitol Tiger Bay Club meeting in Tallahassee. Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Ryan Daly, Blaise Ganey, Lynn Hatter, Gina Jordan, Regan McCarthy, and Sean Mulcahy. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Be sure to join us again next week at this time for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee. For more information about Capitol Report and to hear previous episodes, visit WFSU.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. AbleTrust.org.